English Murder. To Hercule Poirot, there was only one thing more fascinating than the study of human beings, and that was the pursuit of truth. From the Hollow, by Agatha Christie. All I can say is, dear Francis Wyndham, that if I die and go to heaven, or the other place, and it so happens that the public prosecutor of that time is also there, I shall beg him to reveal the secret to me. A letter written by Agatha Christie in 1968 to the editor of the Sunday Times magazine on the subject of the Croydon murders. It was around the middle of the 20th century that Agatha became the phenomenon that is Agatha Christie. In 1945, she was a successful author whose books would sell out a UK hardback print run of around 25,000 copies. By 1950, she was estimated to have sold 50 million books worldwide, and from then on, her sales simply grew and grew. That Agatha's popularity should have increased as her powers declined. After 1950, she wrote a handful of brilliant and unusual books: Destination Unknown, Ordeal by Innocence, The Pale Horse, Endless Night, and Passenger to Frankfurt. But she produced her best work in the 20 previous years, particularly in that period of intense, sustained creativity around the war, which marks the high point of her career. In 1950, she published A Murder is Announced, and this set the standard for much of what followed. Supremely accomplished, utterly readable, but the product of Agatha Christie the phenomenon, rather than Agatha the writer. A further paradox is that the leap into fame did not really come about from the books. It was the adaptations that did the trick, particularly the stage and film versions of And Then There Were None. The conceptual daring of this book had been recognized by readers back in 1939, but a whole new audience was hooked with the wartime dramatization and in 1945 with the 20th Century Fox film directed by René Clair. This was Agatha's first big cinema release, a much larger scale affair than, for instance, the 1937 British film of Love from a Stranger. Agatha later called it bad, although it was far better than the two subsequent films of the book, and it did good box office. The play of the book also ran on Broadway, where it caught the attention of the theatrical impresario Lee Schubert, who took an interest in the dramatized versions of Toward Zero and The Hollow. Later, Schubert proved to be a nightmare. He delayed horribly over The Hollow while refusing to let anyone else near it. Only his death in 1953 released the rights. But that was not the point. The fact was that Agatha was now moving in a different world, the world of success, where everything a writer produces has value and possibilities. Hercule Poirot became a feature on American radio, although Agatha despised these weekly broadcasts and turned down repeated requests from television, including those from her former Poirot, Francis Sullivan, extremely persistent on the subject. The play Hidden Horizon flourished after its initial difficulties, and it too went to New York. In 1949, Agatha's version of Murder at the Vicarage opened in London, followed by The Hollow in 1951, which, according to Edmund Cork, almost burst the Fortune Theatre. And so it went on, reaching a golden peak when a story entitled Witness for the Prosecution, originally titled Traitor Hands, and published in 1925, was dramatized for the West End stage. Out in Iraq in early 1953, Agatha wrote a new ending for the play, which she knew to be sensational. Cork had his doubts about the additional twist, but she was right. Produced by Peter Saunders, the architect of Agatha's theatrical career, who had launched The Mousetrap to minimal fanfare a year earlier, Witness was a staggering triumph. "The play is the biggest success we have had for years," wrote Cork to Harold Ober in December. "It was put on at the worst time of year in the worst theatre in the West End, the Winter Garden, Drury Lane, and it is just packing out." At the beginning of 1954, Agatha threw a party at the Savoy to celebrate the play's success. Among the guests was Campbell Christie, her former brother-in-law, himself now a West End playwright in partnership with his wife, Dorothy. On Broadway, Witness caused the same furore and received a New York Drama Critics Circle Award for Best Foreign Play. "We are receiving numerous inquiries about the play for motion pictures," wrote Ober. After detailed and often excruciating negotiations, "the best we could do was blood, sweat, and tears," as Cork wrote to Ober. The rights were sold for the then newsworthy sum of £116,000, which was given to Rosalind in a tax-evading deed of gift. The film was made by Billy Wilder and starred Charles Laughton, Tyrone Power, and Marlena Dietrich. Stylish, caustic, and relentlessly entertaining, it was the only cinematic version of her writing that Agatha ever liked. It was also a raging hit. Here, though, was another paradox. The greater Agatha's success, the more disastrous became her financial situation. In 1948, she had written to Edmund Cork, "I shall go on enjoying myself and have a slap-up bankruptcy." If this had been meant as a joke, the fact is that it was anything but. How could such a thing have happened? There was now a possibility of the U.S. tax authorities returning to Agatha some of the money that had been impounded since 1941. But as soon as it reached her, it would be taxed into nothing by the British government, even though she needed the American money precisely in order to meet the demands on her depredated British income. The British tax authorities are becoming very difficult indeed, and there seems to be very little likelihood of Mrs. Mallowan avoiding bankruptcy, Cork wrote to Harold Ober in September 1948. "It seems almost incredible to a layman that she should be liable for tax on income which arose in a foreign country and which could not be transmitted to her." The insane fight to avoid bankruptcy would drag on for years yet. The logic of the position was that the British authorities would prefer to destroy Agatha's powerful work ethic or oblige her to move to a tax haven rather than see reason about her liabilities. In March 1949, Agatha wrote to Cork from Baghdad, "Anyway, what the hell is what I now feel about income tax?" Later, she would buckle under the strain of the situation, but at that time, she refused to do so, perhaps refused to believe it could be true. Cork sent her a steady stream of checks for serial rights, play receipts, and so on, and in an act of rather splendid defiance, she behaved as though the shadow of the taxman did not exist, living in the grand style of what she had called her former plutocracy. She no longer thought of selling Greenway, although for tax purposes, it was run as a market gardening business, and, as well as Winterbrook and Cresswell Place, Agatha acquired a new flat in Chelsea's Swan Court, decorated with what she described as paintings that can be lived with. She loved her homes, she loved her gardens, she loved travel, she loved good food, she loved bathing, she loved selective company, she loved freedom and space and munificence, and she continued to revel in these pleasures. They flowered around the work that was the core of her life. She did write less than before, and this caused Cork to panic, as he attributed it to her dislike of working in order to enrich Stafford Cripps. "We are very worried indeed that the anxiety about the tax position has had such a bad effect on Mrs. Mallowan," he wrote to one of his accountants, Norman Dixon, in 1948. Cork's agency, Hughes Massey, had come to rely upon by far our most remunerative client, and her miraculous ability to deliver irresistible manuscripts. But throughout 1948, she wrote nothing. When the war ended, she had had a burst of creativity, almost like an aftershock, which produced three of her best books, The Rose and the Yew Tree, Taken at the Flood, and Crooked House. Then, a spell of silence. Her next full-length book was A Murder Is Announced, written in early 1949, and a very different kind of beast. Thereafter came books like Mrs. McGinty's Dead, They Do It With Mirrors, After the Funeral, and A Pocketful of Rye. all highly competent Agatha Christie on majestic autopilot, and a great deal of theatrical activity, most notably the adaptation for the stage of the radio play Three Blind Mice, which had been written to honour the 80th birthday of Queen Mary in 1947, and in 1952 would open at the Ambassador's Theatre as The Mousetrap. Agatha loved her theatrical successes of the mid-20th century. "I enjoyed writing plays," she later wrote in a tribute to her friend and producer Sir Peter Saunders, whom she had first met when he produced The Hollow. "Not a life project by which to support oneself like books, but enormous fun because of the interesting technique." Despite the extreme popularity of what she wrote, however, Agatha's plays were lightweight things on the whole. Only Akhenaten, set in ancient Egypt, written in 1937 but not produced in her lifetime, and Verdict, a failure when produced in 1958, have any real depth. The dramatizations of the novels show an understanding of the medium. Agatha always knew what worked when it came to writing, but they leech all the subtlety from the originals. The Hollow and Five Little Pigs, or Go Back for Murder, as it was retitled, are greatly enfeebled as plays, almost as if Agatha herself did not realize what had made them such good books. The Westmacott novel, A Daughter's a Daughter, was also first conceived as a play. Although the book does not manage to cut loose from its inherent staginess, it is vastly more light and shade than the theatrical version. But through the 1950s, it was the theatre that engaged much of Agatha's attention, in between producing what Collins began to call It's Christie for Christmas, a slogan that in 1961, William Collins said was good for an extra 26,000 copies. If the profound and compassionate Crooked House had marked the end of an era, then nobody much noticed, least of all the public, which would have been most surprised to learn that a woman reported to earn £2,000 a week was a prospective inhabitant of Queer Street, and which could not get enough of Agatha Christie. It wanted to read her thoughts in newspapers, hear her voice on the radio, study her photographs, collect her autograph, learn her opinions, plague her with fan letters, abuse letters, begging letters, worshipping letters. "It gives me such a respectable feeling to write to a person I adore," a young girl wrote from Pakistan. "You are the second best author in the history of the human race, and only Shakespeare, whom I regret to say I have hardly read, though of course I should have done, is better than you," wrote another fan. A letter came from a woman in Stockport. "I have had another shock this morning. My electric bill came, and it is over £6. Where the money is coming from to pay it, I do not know. Do please be an angel and help me." More forceful was the man who wrote, "2 days ago, I tried to rob the bank in Brecon in Wales. I have written to no less than 40 rich people, even the richest man in the world. Not one of them would even see me. I feel there must be something wrong with me. Only you can save me." From Aberystwyth, a man wrote to protest about a joke remark from Mrs. Oliver, "I never trust the Welsh," in Cards on the Table. "Your veiled attack on the people of Wales has done and will do you and your books much harm." Another man wrote to her to tell her to lose that insufferable Belgian. He had become very wearisome. A young man in Hong Kong, "I am the height of Hercule Poirot," wrote to say, "I admire you and respect you and love you, Miss Christie, more than anything else in the world." She was asked for her thoughts on America. "Have you ever met any anti-Americanism in England?" "No." On Les Grands Sujets Féminines? "Nothing I'd hate more. Tell them so." On the early life of both Poirot and Miss Marple. She was asked where Lapsang Soochong tea could be bought. "Fortnum's," Cork replied. Editors of quotation anthologies asked to use her alleged remark that an archaeologist is the best husband a woman could have, as the older she gets, the more interested he is in her. Cork. "Agatha did not in fact say this, and nothing infuriates her more than to have it attributed to her." Vogue asked if she could tell them what Christmas presents she most wanted to receive. No, she scrawled on the request. The BBC hoped to televise a series of famous people in their homes and film her at Greenway. Literary societies wanted her to speak, the organisers of fetes wanted her to cut ribbons, writers wanted her to read their manuscripts. What silly letters one does get, she wrote to Edmund Cook. People wish to interview her, to know what she thinks about such subjects as student unrest, socialism, girls' clothing, should sex be permissive, and many other things that are no concern of hers. Yes, yes, said Poirot, deplorable, I think. Almost all of this she shunned. Occasionally she gave in to a demand or a plea, as when a company of Dutch ex-POWs wanted to stage a production of Ten Little Niggers. During the war, they had had a copy of the book and dramatized it for performance at Buchenwald concentration camp. This was clearly a very special request. The more usual response was, get me out of this unless you strongly advise it, which Agatha scrawled to Cork in 1951 when asked to do a feature with the pictorial press. The Sunday Express are threatening to telephone you to ask you to contribute to a new publicity feature, wrote Cork in the same year. One of the questions is, what do you dislike most about your career? Which is, I suppose, publicity. A photographic session in 1953 was reluctantly agreed to and instantly regretted. Look here, Edmund, have I got to stand for this? Just about fit for the psychopathic ward is what I should say. From now on, photography is out. I don't see why I should be constantly humiliated and made to suffer. We seem to deal with about 3 photographers a week, Cork wrote to her the following year. In late 1953, an invitation to appear on Panorama was turned down. I'm afraid Mrs. Christie feels that she would definitely not like to appear on television, under any circumstances whatever. She is, as I have told you, very shy, and she hates publicity of any kind. It drove her American agency's obers to distraction. Will Agatha Christie ever consent to be interviewed? They asked in 1965. This, then, was another paradox. The more famous Agatha became, the more she retreated into her private world. Her gardens, the dig house with the new view across the desert, her intimate circle, her writing. What the public saw instead was the construct of Agatha Christie. In the eyes of the world, she became an entity rather than a person. She allowed occasional photographic shoots, such as the 60th birthday pictures taken by Angus McBean, and she appeared, beaming radiantly from inside the collar of one of her fur coats, at openings of her own plays. "Best you've written yet, dearie," she was told, as she emerged onto Drury Lane after the first night of witness for the prosecution. She gave occasional interviews in which she said almost nothing, and she encouraged the image of the Queen of Crime, the Duchess of Death, the woman who looked like a bridge-playing pillar of the community, yet had made more money out of murder than Lucrezia Borgia. What a useful creature this Agatha Christie was. Even when she revealed the inner emotions of her creator, which she frequently did in the years around the war, nobody really noticed. The world was too smitten with the persona. Agatha further complicated the situation by inventing a character, Ariadne Oliver, who is a fictional take on Agatha Christie. Mrs. Oliver, who first appeared in Parker Pyne Investigates, is a large grey-haired woman who writes murder mysteries, eats apples, and is saddled with an imaginary detective, the Finn Sven Hyerson, whom she cannot bear. Of course, he's idiotic, but people like him. It's a wonderful joke, and Mrs. Oliver is a wonderful creation. But she is not Agatha, although occasionally she does speak in her authentic voice. A deal table, her typewriter, black coffee, apples everywhere. What bliss, what glorious and solitary bliss. What a mistake for an author to emerge from her secret fastness. Authors were shy, unsociable creatures, atoning for their lack of social aptitude by inventing their own companions and conversations. The truth is, I'm not very good with people. I adore people, don't you? Said Robin happily. No, said Mrs. Oliver firmly. But you must. Look at all the people in your books. That's different. But Agatha's famed shyness was of a different order from Ariadne Oliver's. Like most things in her older life, it traced back to the events of 1926. As a young married woman, she showed very little evidence of being shy. Quite the opposite, in fact, if her behaviour on the Empire tour is anything to go by, when she socialised willingly and went off without a qualm to stay with the Bell family in Australia, even though she knew none of them beforehand. She also did photographic shoots for the sketch, including some pictures with the very young Rosalind, and showed no dislike of publicising her books. She enjoyed it, in fact. At this point, admittedly, her fame was of a minor order. Nevertheless, it is easy to imagine that if she had remained married to Archie, she would have been less retiring in her later life. Her hatred of publicity derived almost entirely from the period of her notoriety, when journalists had written a story that was not merely wrong, but that would not have existed at all had it not been for their desire to create it. Also, and more subtly, it was not enough for her to hate publicity. She wanted her hatred to be made public. In so doing, she was continuing to suppress any lingering belief that she had disappeared in order to advance her career. Of course, if Agatha had remained married to Archie, that great imponderable, she might never have become Agatha Christie at all. Almost certainly, she would not have looked like her. Her large, comfortable physicality was a defense against wounds, and after the war, it grew more massive still. She lost the last trace of the attraction she had held until her early 50s for a man like Stephen Glanville. Her weight rose to nearly 15 stone, her legs swelled immensely, and she became extraordinarily sensitive about photographs. Those taken at Greenway show a relaxed, rather splendid woman with a sweet smile, a penetrating eye, and, as often as not, one of Rosalind's Manchester terriers perched upon her like a tiny black and tan deer. These images are charming, but they were intensely private. The wider world was less forgiving, as Agatha was only too aware. So her shyness may have arisen partly from a desire only to be seen by people who knew her well. A friend of Stephen Glanville's daughter met Agatha at lunch in the 1950s at the Provost's Lodge at King's College. "I know I thought the sight of her surprising, with a fat, somewhat uncoordinated body and messily applied lipstick." This was the truth, as Agatha herself knew. But seeing it confirmed in photographs saddened her, as she confessed to Edmund Cork. "One doesn't really, thank the Lord, know just how awful one looks," she wrote in April 1957. "Oh well, good for one? No." It was the same feeling she had had after 1926. Of a terrible divergence between the way she was seen and the way she saw herself. She felt its poignancy as she created girls like the radiant Gina Hudd in They Do It With Mirrors, who says of her beauty, "It doesn't last very long, you know." In her secret imaginative self, Agatha was still in touch with the Gina she had once been. Sitting in her garden at Greenway, she felt the presence of the young Miss Miller, sunlit and joyful, within the massive, becalmed woman she had become. Out in the world, this illusion was not really possible. Too much reality obtruded. Thus, the fame that exposed and constrained Agatha's life also became necessary to her, because it brought her the means to be private and free. She was secretive too, however, about the cause of the fame, her writing. "How on earth is it done?" said her Penguin publisher and friend Alan Lane in Close Up, a radio program about Agatha broadcast in 1955. This was indeed the question. The time came when we reprinted 10 Agatha Christie titles, 100,000 of each. We sold something like 2.5 million of these 10 stories alone. I know from her output alone that is a prodigious worker, and yet I've never been conscious of her having done any work at all. Even her family knew nothing of her writing. She would just announce at dinner that she had something to read to us, said her son-in-law Anthony, and we'd all groan. Unlike most writers, Agatha had no desire to inflict her creative anguish on those around her. She simply disappeared to a room, rarely at Greenway. Her books were chiefly written at Winterbrook or in the East, and got on with it. It was impressive to achieve such a separation, and it had never been Agatha's way to mystify what she did. Yet somehow, this made it all the more mysterious. Although she never again wrote with the fervor of the years around the war, she was still possessed by a creative compulsion. What she called lazy, one book a year, was what most writers could consider highly industrious, particularly when aged over 60. Writing was the center of her life, a demonstrable truth that she sought always to deny. In Come Tell Me How You Live, she portrayed herself as a dutiful archaeologist's wife, and in her autobiography, as a very normal person who lived her life with delighted gusto and wrote books on the side, such a nuisance, in order to pay for her pleasures. Dear Agatha, the talented amateur who happened to hit the jackpot and who never thought of herself as a real writer, just a lucky and hard-working craftswoman. What did books matter compared with cooking meals and going for drives and cleaning ivories with Pond's cold cream on Max's digs? But this was disingenuous. Another facet of the construct of Agatha Christie, the nice, ordinary lady who happened to have a talent to deceive. I can't imagine why I do so much, she said in her 1969 interview with The Observer. Especially as I say, this is the last one I'll ever write, whenever one is finished. She also spoke on the 1955 close-up program, a safe piece of publicity presumably since trusted people like Alan Lane and Richard Attenborough were contributors, saying, I do find that one's friends are curious about the way one works. What is your method, they want to know. Well, the disappointing truth is that I haven't much method. And if you lead a pretty busy life, as I do, it's very difficult to find a couple of weeks without any interruptions. The guardedness about her writing went deep and was, in its way, another byproduct of 1926. She wanted to keep herself hidden from view in every possible sense. She wrote as Agatha Christie, which was a formidable protection, and she wrote as Mary Westmacott, which was a protection until 1949, when the Atticus column in the Sunday Times revealed that she and Agatha were one and the same. This had not been a state secret. Agatha must have known that the story would come out at some time, but she had not wanted it to. The Westmacott reviews tended to be far better than the reviews she got as Agatha Christie, but she did not want them for herself. Up until the end, she always insisted that the Westmacotts were marketed separately, as if by a different author, never under the name of Agatha Christie. That would have brought them too close to home. She felt an absolute freedom writing those books. She could go wherever she wanted, into every idea that had ever fascinated her, even into the recesses of her own past. Although she wrote two inferior but no less interesting Westmacotts in the 1950s, A Daughter's a Daughter and The Burden, there was a sense that the revelation of her identity had closed a door, the one that opened into her most private and precious imaginative garden. It's really all washed up, she wrote to Cork. Almost all her best writing was done between 1930 and 1950, the years when she sheltered behind the name of her mysterious other self. I think people should be interested in books and not their authors, so Agatha wrote to Edmund Cook's daughter, Pat, in 1964. When she spoke about her writing in interviews, it was in the broadest terms. I suppose it's just like making sauce. Sometimes you get all the ingredients just right. She was giving nothing away, and indeed, why should she? The only real clues to what she did and how she did it come from the evidence of her own writing notebooks. Almost 70 survive, and they show that beneath the pose of ease and amateurishness, she worked extraordinarily hard to shape her plots. It is typical that Agatha did not buy notebooks specifically for her own use, but would scribble her ideas anywhere. She used her daughter's school exercise books. Rosalind Christie Scotswood, Devonish Road, Sunningdale, 1925. And a Gabler, Dagothea Miller, dated 1907, from her finishing school in Paris. She jotted ideas between shopping lists, bridge scores, or diary entries. Out to dinner, 8 o'clock Morton's. The thoughts on Caribbean mystery are interrupted by Peter Tones, Kettle, Cutlery, Two Pans. Before sketching the plot for Curtain, she wrote these lines on Peter. "You are no longer with us, and the days shall go more soberly, my well-beloved dog and dearest friend." Get petrol coupons, she reminded herself, before launching into a chapter breakdown of sparkling cyanide. In the middle of detailed notes about poisons, she printed pairs of names with the matching letters crossed out to see what remained, and whether the couple was compatible. Archibald Christie is paired with Agatha Mary Clarissa Christie. Archibald is paired with Agatha. She also paired Reginald Lucy with Agatha Christie, perhaps to see if that half-regretted suitor might still prove a good bet as a husband. Among the notes for her very last book, Postern of Fate, she wrote, "Next make a list of characters," as if reminding herself of what Agatha Christie did. In between her thoughts is a passage from Psalm 84, and a note about paisley dress, hip size 46, advertised in the Daily Express. Essence of Agatha. Agatha was not ritualistic or writerly about her notebooks. She had always been able to write anywhere, on the kitchen table at Addison Mansions with Rosalind in her cot, in a hotel bedroom, on a table, in a dig house, and she could write in any kind of exercise book. She never needed a special pen, a particular typewriter, the props that most writers use to ease themselves in. Despite the external separation that Agatha made between work and life, inside there was a constant flow from one to the other. Ideas came easily to her. She saw them everywhere. But she went surprisingly roundabout to find her plots. A reader might imagine that at the heart of her books lay one central twist or trick around which a structure was built. In fact, the process was more haphazard and empirical. Structure did not come naturally to Agatha. Her first book, the teenage novel Snow in the Desert, showed that she could write dialogue and understand human motivation with no trouble at all, but had no idea whatever of how to construct a story. This she learned, but the prevalent belief that she did it mathematically, as if working out an equation, is not really accurate. The finished product might give that impression. The workings out do not. She arrived at her structure rather in the manner of a bird building a nest, taking this, rejecting that, recognizing what was needed when she saw it, by some means ending up with a smooth and watertight hole. Foreign girl, Yugoslavian, looks after old lady who lives with niece and husband or nephew and wife, leaves her money to girl, Sonia, anger, suspicion. Evidence against Sonia found. Thus Agatha jotted the origins of Halloween party, adding at the end, "Good idea, needs working out." She collected possibilities, of course. With her notebooks are various cuttings. Notes on poisons. Pilocarpine has no post-mortem appearance. Thallium, similar to chronic arsenical poisoning. A letter in the British Medical Journal about a patient living for hours after being stabbed. A letter from her own solicitors, Hooper and Wallen of Torquay, giving an opinion on the Legitimacy Act, 1926. A letter from Madge in 1935, giving information she had obtained about insulin. "I'm very glad, by the way, that your need to know is professional, not personal." There are also letters from Agatha's doctor friends, the MacLeods, who she met in Iraq. "Peter is a bit dubious about the Evipan murdering being correct," wrote his wife Peggy, in response to a query about Lord Edgware dies. He says that probably after death it won't be eliminated, and so would be discovered. It is used as a sleeping draught. In a notebook from the late 1930s, Agatha wrote the heading, An Alphabet of Ideas, an oddly touching challenge to herself to come up with 26 possibilities. Some were more substantial than others, but all show that she could see the potential of anything. C, for example, reads, debutantes, teas, etc., mothers killed off in rapid succession, which sheds light on what was going through Agatha's mind during Rosalind's season. D, dangerous drugs stolen from doctor's car, played a small part, nearly 20 years later, in Hickory Dickory Dock. E, Poirot asked to go down to country, finds a house with a dead man in it, and various fantastic details. Was a visual image used in the hollow. F, legless man, and I, arsenic taken, looks like caviar, were ideas to which Agatha repeatedly returned, although she could never make them work. J, a murderer, after execution evidence proves he was innocent, was the central premise for The Five Little Pigs. It is interesting that some of her thoughts were extremely macabre. A stabbing through the eye, a steel window shutter acting as a guillotine, a cat with its throat cut, and that they were all discarded. Ideas took various forms, some related to Agatha's knowledge of poison. The poison that makes everything yellow, applied to dress. B, misleading, as another girl had yellow dress. Some were connected to place. Caribbean, Miss M, after illness. Bogus major like a frog. He squints. Which became a Caribbean mystery. Others were about motive. The rubella idea lay at the heart of the mirror cracked from side to side. Deathbroker idea became the pale horse. Some books came easily. The notes on Lord Edgware dies are almost identical to the finished article. So too with Evil Under the Sun. Scene, hotel on island, Bigbury, which Agatha sketched to perfection, then tussled with various complicated plot permutations before returning to her original. This was something she did frequently. Her energetic mind was not easily satisfied. What would be best? This? That? Some books cost her agonies before arriving at their eventual form. Among these was the boldly conceptual The ABC Murders, whose central idea seems so simple but emerged only from a good deal of muddly thought. They Do It With Mirrors went through several different forms along the way, two of which branched off to become A Pocketful of Rye and A Murder Is Announced. Third Girl is not an especially complicated book, but Agatha went through pages of notes, even drawing a family tree, in her attempts to build a plot. Among her many thoughts was a twist about a forged will. This was discarded for Third Girl, recycled in Halloween Party. Little was wasted, even when Agatha was in her 70s. A 1966 notebook has an idea for the cyanide murder, which was not developed, although its National Trust tour setting was used in Nemesis. This was the sensible side of Agatha, completely at odds with the reckless person who travelled the world first class and owned the majestic Greenway, while owing thousands in back tax. The side she had inherited or learned from women like her grandmother, Margaret Miller, and wrote into her character Lucy Islesborough, the Oxford graduate who becomes a housekeeper and makes use of leftover potatoes in a Spanish omelette. Agatha refused to be profligate with ideas. She was once asked by a jovial Cecil Day Lewis, a sometime writer of detective fiction, if she would sell him a few of the 17 plots he believed her to have in hand. "Certainly not," she replied in the same spirit. "I intend to write them myself." She did not need to be given ideas, although on two occasions she accepted them because they came to her from anything. Taken at the Flood, for example, was another book that went through many changes. Its starting point, noted at least 12 years before the book was written, was simply the name Enoch Arden. Such a slight thing, a quotation, a phrase, could become a hook from which to hang the plot. Ideas in a notebook from February 1937 included A. Rose Without Thorn and D. I'm Afraid of Being Hanged, which became Sad Cypress and Toward Zero, respectively. H. Old Lady in Train was probably the origin of Murder is Easy. So a single page contained the germ of three books. Fragments of dialogue also abound in her notes. They were the connective tissue in her construction, as in these notes on curtain. H. Hastings at Stiles has heard about P. Poirot from Egypt, his arthritis. I am here because a crime is going to be committed. You are going to prevent it? No, I can't do that. It is certain to happen because the person who has made up his mind will not relent. Listen. H. Stupefied. Agatha did not necessarily know who her murderer would be until some way into the planning of a book. She had worked out much of her plot for Crooked House, for example, before considering where to point the finger of guilt. Her old friend, the legless man, also made an appearance. Does Lawrence do it? A cripple. Really no legs, therefore is always different heights. Better for Pocketful of Rye, brother who comes from abroad. Or shall it be Clemency? Dorcas? No, Clemency. Yes. Her motive, fanatical, slightly mad. Edith? Yes, possible. Emma? Yes, interesting. Similarly with Hickory Dickory Dock. Hickory Road, who is killed and why? Then, when she had her victim? Why did C have to die? What did she know? Her notes on Dead Man's Folly were even blunter. Who wants to kill who? With Mrs. McGinty's dead, Agatha had her central idea, but again no culprit. Tryouts. Maureen's husband did it. His wife, E.K.'s daughter. Does young woman E.K.'s daughter prevail upon Robin Upward to kill Mrs. McGinty? Says she is blackmailing her. Maud is Lily Gamble or Craig Child. How about Maud? Under the title 1-2 Buckle My Shoe, she simply wrote, who, why, when, how, where, which. Neither was Agatha always sure which of her detectives to use in a book, and quite often she replaced Miss Marple with Poirot. This argues against the prevalent belief that she grew to loathe Poirot. No doubt he was easier to use because, as a proper detective, he could be called into any situation, although the original idea for A Cat Among the Pigeons, that Miss Marple should have a relation at the girls' school where the book is set, is entirely plausible. Death on the Nile was originally a Marple, but this book changed almost completely from its early form and eventually became Appointment with Death. The Pale Horse, which has no detective, was also conceived as a Marple story. Occasionally, Agatha changed her titles. Alternatives to The Hollow were Tragic Weekend and Return Journey. And some of her characters acquired new names along the way. Jacko Argyle in Ordeal by Innocence was originally Albert. Ruby in The Body in the Library was Queenie. Judge Wargrave in And Then There Were None was Mr. Justice Swettenham. Miss Arundel in Dumb Witness was Miss Westmacott. There was even a Mrs. Pooper in the original Nile appointment plot, a cheap novelist who became the character Salome Otterbourne. I can't start writing till I can get names that I feel fit, she wrote to Edmund Cork. And one of her minor talents was her instinct for the right name, the right book title. Nick Buckley, Eleanor Carlyle, Caroline Crail, Lucy Anquetil, Bess Sedgwick, Franklin Clark, Alistair Blunt, Boyd Carrington, Sir Stafford Nye, Ratchet Blaw. These are all marvellous names, flavoursome but not overdone. She rarely used the names of people she knew, although she did use Devon place names, Luscombe, Christo, but Inspector Neil is an interesting exception. He investigates both A Pocketful of Rye and Third Girl. This went unnoticed, although a Monsieur Nicoletis in France accused Agatha of libeling his mother with the portrayal of the drunk, aggressive Mrs. Nicolettis in Hickory Dickory Dock. I invented the name of Nicolettis. It's terrible that if you invent a character, it should come out so true to life. Positively uncanny. Even her apparently banal titles have a power that helped to establish her position as the definitive crime writer. Murder on the Orient Express. Lord Edgware Dies, Death on the Nile. But the title Toward Zero is masterly, as are Dumb Witness, Evil Under the Sun, A Murder is Announced, After the Funeral, Ordeal by Innocence, and Nemesis. Her titles were frequently changed for the American market, and invariably for the worse. Of course, many of her titles are quotations from Shakespeare, Tennyson, Blake, and the Book of Revelation, or from nursery rhymes, a clever idea of which she made considerable use. It tapped into the desire in readers to have a murder placed within a contradictory context. The vicarage, the country house, the luxury train. It reassured, but it had a sinister aspect, hinting as it did, literally, in the case of one of her books, at evil lurking within the world of childhood. It was also simply clever. Clever in a simple way. This was what Agatha could do, and where she differed from a contemporary like Dorothy L. Sayers, who was clever in a complicated and ostentatious way. Sayers would never have invented the murderer who pretends to be a serial killer in order to commit a single murder, or who makes a particular bid in bridge to distract attention from a crime. These coups of Agatha are almost blinding. They are such direct hits, and they cut to the heart of her art. Sayers has coups of her own, the haemophiliac whose condition misleads as to the time of death, the arsenic eater who dines with his victim, but they are presented to the reader in a completely different way, with, as it were, the workings out still visible. Simplicity sets Agatha apart. It was hard won, as her notebooks make clear, but she knew that it was the desired end. The finished product had to be impregnable. Its geometry had to be capable of being turned this way and that, like a jewel in the sunlight. It had to be constructed so that it could be satisfyingly dismantled. Then everything had to be hidden from view. Because of her simplicity, she has been misunderstood. The removal from her books of any trace of authorial presence, the refusal to admit of any interference between the reader and the genre, the unfathomable gap between the artistic sphere in which her plots have reality and the real world. These are the things that give her work its translucent, almost mythic quality. And yet, seen from another angle, these qualities become defects, a lack of depth and substance. Nevertheless, they were deliberate on her part. She knew perfectly well how to write books that grappled with unfinished, insoluble, raggedy real life. Mary Westmacott has an honourable walk-on part in the story of the 20th century novel. But Agatha Christie did not choose to write in that way. Among the writers of classic detective novels, Sayers, Marjorie, Allingham, Nio Marsh, Agatha Christie was the only one who did not allow herself to intrude upon her books. Nio Marsh, for example, was probably more interested in theatre than in detective fiction, and did not hesitate to make this plain in many of her novels. The books of Dorothy L. Sayers are full of knowledge that is obviously and proudly her own. Campanology in The Nine Tailors, the advertising industry in Murder Will Advertise, academic life in Gaudy Night. And while this may delight or bore according to taste, it is also obviously the knowledge of a woman who is amusing herself by writing in a genre which she could, and later would, do something more artistically strenuous. Agatha was also capable of doing other things, but she never felt the need to hint at them in her detective fiction. She kept to its limits and never patronized them. Nor did she invent a detective who was anything other than a function of the genre. Hercule Poirot was a mysterious artistic reality, but he is also, and only, a detective. An omniscient brain, a deus ex machina, an emblem of impersonal truth. Because of his profession, he has a detachment from life, which he is once heard to regret after reading the first lines of Homer's Odyssey in the labours of Hercule. Was there here something that he had missed? Some richness of spirit? Sadness crept over him. Miss Marple, too, lives aside from the world. She is essentially an observer, although she does play a recognizable social role in a way that Poirot does not. The other detectives of the classic murder mystery are not so much detached from the world as from the genre they inhabit. They are all surprising people for the job, unlike Poirot, who is a natural. Marjorie Allingham's Campion and Naomasha's Allen are gentlemen, set above their genre by class, and in Allen's case, by the encyclopedic knowledge of Shakespeare and a powerful sex appeal. Nobody has ever met a policeman quite like him. Lord Peter Wimsey is also a gentleman, but so much else besides. Balliol scholar, war hero, glass of fashion, advocate of equal rights for women, and highly accomplished lover. Midway through his career, Sayers gives him a passion for Harriet Vane, an independent-spirited woman who writes detective fiction. A version of her creator, of course, although there is also an intriguing subconscious. Hint of Agatha? In Strong Poison, Harriet is accused of murdering her lover. She is triumphantly acquitted, but her reputation suffers for some years afterwards. At the time of the trial, it is said that the wretched woman's sales are going up by leaps and bounds, and another character offers the opinion that the whole thing is a publicity stunt gone wrong. Being tried on a capital charge is not at all the same thing as disappearing for 11 days, but in both cases, the women were innocent of the central charges against them, and guilty of more minor sins. And there is something of Agatha during the period after 1926, in Have His Carcass, which depicts Harriet's life after her acquittal. In that book, she is portrayed as scathed and embittered, bracing herself for recognition every time she gives her name. At the same time, she has never been more successful. Harriet Vane thrillers were booming. Wimsey, who falls in love with Harriet despite the scandal, is Dorothy L. Sayers' ideal man. Her crush on him caused much mirth among her fellow members of the detective club, and it seems that the female crime writer does tend to invest her detective with the qualities she admires in a man. She also uses him as a symbol of her own literary ambition, which goes way beyond the limitations of the genre. Wimsey is far too deep and sensitive a person to inhabit the world of detective fiction. So is P.D. James' Adam Dalgliesh, a highly romantic figure with a tragic past and a poetic gift. So too Ruth Rendell's Wexford, a broad-minded liberal with a complex family life and a deep love of English literature. They are all too good to be detectives, all too good for the genre, all that is, except Poirot. He alone is happy in his world. So was his creator. This was not lack of ambition on Agatha's part. It was simply her instinct. She could always do more than she let on, but she did not want to draw attention to the fact. For reasons that were both personal and artistic, she liked to subsume herself within the genre. When she invented complex characters like Henrietta Savernake in The Hollow or The Crates in Five Little Pigs, she did not allow them to cloud the shining simplicity. When she dealt in complex themes like the nature of justice in Murder on the Orient Express, she refused to explore them outside the geometry. It is very often women who write and read these books, but Agatha, for all her genteel settings, domestic detail and unwillingness to describe physical violence, was probably the least feminine of any of the writers of classic detective fiction. Usually, there is a sense that female crime writers are using the genre because it is fantastical and safe. It enables them to go so far in their contemplation of death and sex and darkness, then to be thankfully reined in again. It enables them to explore relationships within a grid a pattern, rather than in the vast expanses opened up by ordinary fiction. It allows the creation of an idealized figure, the detective, whom they can color in with whatever characteristics they choose. It allows them to transcend the genre as much and as cleverly as they wish, in the comforting knowledge that it will, in the end, provide a literary safety net. However much depth is put into a piece of detective fiction, it will never have the power that it would within a straight novel. It will always be bound within the rules of its world. That is the delight and limitation of the genre, for both writer and reader. Agatha worked with it rather than against it. She accepted and embraced its impersonal structure. She did not want to be like Dorothy Sayers, making herself vulnerable, even ridiculous, as she paraded too much of her knowledge and her unfulfilled passions. If Agatha revealed herself, she would do so either under another name or within a highly controlled environment, the impregnable world of Agatha Christie. In 1966, Frances Windham wrote in the Sunday Times, "Agatha Christie epitomizes the cozy school of crime fiction. All classic detective fiction is cozy, up to a point, but there is no doubt that she came to symbolize the genre. She acknowledged as much when she wrote The Body in the Library, a title that comes close to being ironic. She was also, of course, a mystery in her own right. Although it had not been her intention, the 1926 disappearance had fixed her in the public mind as a woman whose smiling facade concealed impenetrable depths. This was the real point about her image. It became synonymous with what she wrote. Agatha Christie became the living definition of classic English mystery fiction, the respectable veneer that hides the mayhem beneath. While Mrs. Christie looks and dresses like a happy provincial matron who has experienced nothing worse than the thunderstorm which wrecked the flower show, she has, in fact, been getting away with murder," wrote the Daily Express in 1950. This was the way she wanted to present herself, because it protected her so completely from view. But the image took on a greater significance. It came to embody the very idea of English murder. Raymond West waved murder away with his cigarette. "Murder is so crude," he said. "I take no interest in it." That statement did not take me in for a moment. They say all the world loves a lover. Apply that saying to murder, and you have an even more infallible truth. So wrote Agatha Christie in The Murder of the Vicarage, published in 1930, 5 years after the period delineated by George Orwell as the golden era of murder. Our Elizabethan period, as he calls it dryly, in his essay Decline of the English Murder. For him, English murder was at its most fascinating between 1850 and 1925, a span of time that takes in cases like those of Constant Kent, Charles Bravo, Madeline Smith, Frederick Seddon, Hawley Harvey Crippen, George Joseph Smith, Herbert Armstrong, and Thompson Bywaters. Orwell viewed such murder cases with a mesmerized artistic eye, as a perverse symbol of Middle England. He saw in them an irreducible paradox, because they used the ultimate act of disorder as a means to maintain the status quo. For example, murder committed in order to get money to maintain the life one had before the murder. This was murder for gain, the favored Christie motive. Like Orwell, though, Agatha was also intrigued by the notion of guilty passion leading people into an impossible situation from which the easiest means of escape becomes murder. The motivation is the desire to preserve appearances, to keep everything as it was. As Orwell puts it, not to forfeit one's social position by some scandal, such as a divorce. Crippen is the template of the Orwellian murderer. Married to a lascivious harridan, he fell for his quiet and ladylike secretary, Ethel Deneve, but divorce in 1909 from a partner who was determined not to agree to it was a near impossibility. Crippen took the other escape route. After burying his wife under the cellar, he told their friends she had gone on a trip to America, and yes, of course, he would send her their regards. Then he looked forward to a life of bliss with Miss Leneve. This would have been the kind of murder of which Archie Christie was suspected in 1926, and which, according to Unfinished Portrait, Agatha feared briefly he might commit. The Thompson Bywaters murder was born of a similar situation. Edith Thompson, whose husband was stabbed in 1922 by her young lover, had no hand in the actual crime, but she was certainly guilty of wanting to keep up her respectable lifestyle while conducting a romantic affair, an untenable situation which eventually led Bywaters to commit his crime passionnel. Unless her husband had been amenable to divorce, which, like Cora Crippen, he empathetically was not, Mrs. Thompson could not leave him without losing her reputation, her job, and, although she earned more than her husband, her comfortable Edwardian villa in the then-genteel suburb of Ilford. She was stuck because divorce was simply too difficult to deal with. It required her to lose too much, and human nature being what it is, she was not prepared to give up her lover either. For those who wanted, in the cheap phrase, to have it all, murder was often quite simply the only option. He wanted to marry the girl, you see. She's very respectable, and so is he. And besides, he's devoted to his children and didn't want to give them up. He wanted everything: his home, his children, his respectability, and Elsie. And the price he would have to pay for that was murder. So says Miss Marple in The Moving Finger, in a passage that might well be called the sacred text of English murder. It is the ordinariness that is at the heart of it. Crippen, standing outside his front door in Hilldrop Crescent, waving to his neighbours, chatting politely about his wife, whose body lay a few feet away from them. Most of the interest and part of the terror of great crime are due not to what is abnormal, but to what is normal in it, wrote Filson Young in his essay on Crippen. That is what fascinated Agatha, the same tension that Orwell described between the life that goes on as before and the terrible unseen rupture at its heart. George Joseph Smith marrying yet another wife, standing at the altar, smiling happily, one part of his mind fixed upon the moment when he will drag her feet up from the bottom of the bath and let her head go under. Herbert Armstrong, strutting along the streets of Wye, the local solicitor saying his good mornings with a neat little packet of arsenic in his pocket. It is called cozy, this distancing of death by turning it into stories, dressing it up in frock coats and cloche hats, focusing on the quotidian to accentuate all the more the one moment in the day that is not ordinary, not familiar, that is a small, black, impenetrable mystery. It is childish in a way. Grimm's fairy tales for grown-ups. Real death, real murder, is not English murder. It is dirty and smeared and grief-stricken. We know that. But the other is irresistible because it is a story that follows the rules of behaviour so perfectly in every way, bar one, and leaves the human dynamic so beautifully plain to see. In English murder, motive is always at the heart of the matter. It is money, or it is passion, or it is fear. It is the ordinary made extreme. This was what interested Agatha. Murder without recognizable motive, human motive, ordinary motive, meant nothing to her. Hence her lifelong obsession with the Croydon murders, the members of the Duff family, in and out of the kitchen, talking about everyday things, one of them with a hidden intent to kill, and later, the unsolved Bravo case, about which she wrote a letter to Francis Wyndham, which was published in 1968 in the Sunday Times magazine. I myself think it was Dr. Gully who killed Charles Bravo. There were two other chief suspects, the wife Florence and the companion Mrs. Cox. All three had opportunity, so Agatha considered the far more interesting question of human nature. I've always felt that he, Gully, was the only person who had an overwhelming motive and who was the right type. exceedingly competent, successful, and always considered above suspicion. Agatha dismissed Florence Bravo because she had all the money and thus no motive. She always had the whip hand. Mrs. Cox was an obvious suspect at first glance, but not when you look into it. A timid and prudent character. The Bravo idea would entail woman widow having affair with a doctor, which was an idea jotted in one of Agatha's notebooks, but she did not develop it. However, both the Croydon and the Bravo cases were in Agatha's mind when she conceived Ordeal by Innocence, the story of a family thrown into turmoil when a murder case, considered solved, is reopened, and they are forced to consider which of them might have killed Rachel Argyle, wife and adoptive mother to four children. It reminds me, you know, of the Bravo case. No one now can ever know the truth. And so Florence Bravo, abandoned by her family, died alone of drink, and Mrs. Cox, ostracized, and with three little boys, lived to be an old woman, with most of the people she knew believing her to be the murderess. And Dr. Gully was ruined professionally and socially. Someone was guilty and got away with it, but the others were innocent and didn't get away with anything. Agatha also alluded to the Crippen case, directly but glancingly, in one of the short stories in The Labours of Hercules, which contains the line, "I've always wondered if Ethel Lenevre was in it with him or not." Perhaps the answer to this question is given in Mrs. McGinty's Dead. Mrs. McGinty is murdered because she has recognized someone in her village from a newspaper cutting, a Where Are They Now story relating to four murderesses. One of the cases in the newspaper is clearly based upon Crippen and Lenevre. Craig kills his wife, is hanged for the crime, and protects his mistress, Eva Kane, throughout the trial. But the story makes plain that she had encouraged the idea of murder. In Crooked House, there are echoes of the Thompson Bywaters murder. An actress, Magda Leonides, hopes to play the part of Edith Thompson in a new play. Occasional references are made to this, and it becomes a delicate motif throughout. When a cache of love letters is found, written by Brenda, the young wife of the victim, anyone familiar with the Thompson Bywaters case will recognize the allusion. Edith Thompson was convicted of conspiracy to murder almost solely on the evidence of her letters to Frederick Bywaters. I was thinking of the desperate terror on Brenda's face. It had seemed familiar to me, and suddenly I realized why. It was the same expression that I had seen on Magda Leonides' face the first day I had come to the Crooked House, when she had been talking about the Edith Thompson play. And then she had said, "Sheer terror, don't you think so?" A detective novel by Dorothy L. Sayers, The Documents in the Case, is also, as the title implies, reminiscent of the Thompson Bywaters case. In it, a character makes this remarkable little speech. "The suburbs are the only places left where men and women will die and persecute for their beliefs. The blessed people of the suburbs, they do believe in something. They believe in respectability. They lie, die, commit murder to keep up appearances. Look at Crippen. Look at Bywaters. Look at the man who hid his dead wife in a bath and ate his meals on the lid for fear somebody should suspect a scandal. My God!" It is not entirely superficial, this idea of the English murder. It is not merely cozy, this fascination with an ordered universe in which a disordered act is committed and hopes to go unnoticed. It is a fascination with people in the end. People are not just their emotions. They are the interplay between their inner and outer selves. And this is what English murder distills to its essence. It is what Agatha Christie distilled. She did have a knack for creating puzzles. She had a brain that seized upon potential plots. She had a conceptual daring that enabled her to imagine a different kind of solution, wherein the culprit was not simply one of a set of possible suspects, as in almost every other example of crime fiction. With her, the solution was not merely a question of one guilty party among a cast of innocents. It could be everybody or nobody or a child or the apparent victim. The surprise was not in who did it, but in the possibilities within the very idea of the solution.